Hello, and welcome to Spartan Speak, a podcast from the Lansing State Journal and Detroit Free Press, focused on Michigan State sports. I'm Phil Friend, your host, producer, and sports writer for LSJ, joined by, as always, Lansing State Journal sports columnist Grant Couch and Detroit Free Press beat writer Chris Solari. Chris, how are you doing?
Just kind of getting through the long month of November when you have the overlap. It definitely is a grind month. There's no question about that. So kind of trying to come out of that and enjoy a December that's going to be busier than normal, it seems like.
Graham, how about you?
You know, it's weird because November is one of those months that is a lot. But I always really enjoy it. It's one of my favorite months in the job. But I would never want to do it twice in a row. You know, it's like everything collides and everything's exciting, and then you're always a little glad it's done.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that this month you will get like almost a full week off from I think it's over a full week. I think it's like 8 or 9 days away from Michigan State basketball with finals week and everything. But then we come right back with 2 Big Ten games before the end of the year. Not to mention a couple of non-conference games sprinkled in. So.
Not to mention potentially a trip to New York for the Heisman.
Yeah, got that. And then, of course, a to-be-determined Michigan State football bowl game. We don't know when that's going to be. That will be determined depending on how Michigan does this week. And
we'll learn that on Sunday.
Yeah, and other factors. So, yeah.
We'll learn that on Sunday after all the conference championship games are done.
Yeah. Well, Chris, you talked about a very muddled November with a lot of football and basketball. And those are the two things, of course, we are going to talk about this week. But we are going to start in the football realm, where on last Saturday, Michigan State concluded its regular season with a 30-27 victory over Penn State in beautiful, beautiful Michigan weather, if 3 inches of snow is your thing. But that gave the Spartans a 10-win season and a chance to make a New Year's Six bowl game, which, considering this team went 2-5 a year ago, I mean, all those storylines have been talked about and played out, you know, in media and on this podcast. But to go 10-2 in Mel Tucker's second season is quite the accomplishment, Chris.
I just want to point out what I said last week, that Penn State still has James Franklin as head coach. First and foremost, I think that's an important thing for 10 more years and a lot of money.
He did not get as much as Mel Tucker.
Not as much as Mel Tucker that we know of, but that it was a big win. And I think Graham brought it up by calling it a program win, kind of hearkening back to those hats from a few years ago. But this really was for a number of reasons. I think the fact that, you know, Thanksgiving weekend draws are really tough for Michigan State and have been, in the 25 years I've been around. And that was a pretty darn good crowd. Whatever the enticements were to get the students to bring friends or whatever it was for the ticket prices for people, they had bodies in the seats that made it a pretty hostile environment, which I think that needs to be credited first and foremost. And then, you know, the team, I thought, responded to that, and they responded to the ability to win 10 games and all of the challenges that laid in front of them. They made an impression, I think, on the college football playoff selection committee, which is important because, you know, if you want to get one of those New Year's Six bowls, the CFP selection committee is the one that basically puts you in them. They're the ones that select them and they then point to the destination. So, you know, barring any catastrophic chaos that could come on Saturday, you know, it sure seems like either the Fiesta Bowl or the Peach Bowl are a very likely destination. If all that chaos plays out, I think is where it could get a little dicey, Graham.
It looks right now, as long as the favorites win out, you know, that they're in. We say that having seen what happened in 2014 with the Mississippi State, Michigan State flip on the day of the bowl selection with neither team having played the previous Saturday. So there is precedent for for like the last second unexpected movement. And that year is famously for me the year that I booked a bunch of us on trips to the Orange Bowl only to have the Cotton Bowl be a non-refundable tickets that we then had vouchers for the next year with American Airlines. It was one of my great travel gaffes. But like at that moment,
Traveled American was the first gaffe.
Well, that might have been it. But I remember sitting there and everybody else is like thinking about the storylines that just happened with the change to the Cotton Bowl from the Orange Bowl, and all I can think about is I just booked like $3,000 worth of travel that is non-refundable on the company dime to a place we're not going. So one thing that's interesting though is when you look, you listen to Michigan State fans, and there's a lot of people would rather not go to a New Year's Six Bowl if Michigan can lose and bump them, you know, and even if Iowa then bumps Michigan State into the Citrus Bowl. And I understand that train of thinking. And I think there's two reasons for that. One, I think that's just natural fan reaction. You don't want Michigan in the playoff. You don't want them having a Big Ten championship. The things you've been able to say you've done that they haven't, is your program's time to ascend again. You don't want their program doing something like that. I also think there's a difference between the Fiesta Bowl and the Peach Bowl in terms of brand. And like the Peach Bowl may be a New Year's Six Bowl. And they've made it one. That's fine. It's been around a long time. The Fiesta Bowl has gravitas, right? The Fiesta Bowl has been a national championship. It's been a game around forever. That's a big deal. You play like Notre Dame in a Fiesta Bowl, that's a big deal. I don't think the Peach Bowl and the Citrus Bowl, no matter what you label it, the Peach Bowl on December 30th versus the Citrus Bowl versus an SEC team on January 1, in most people's eyes, is no different. And I think people, if that meant, you know, if I don't think people would really care about that difference, playing an SEC opponent in the Citrus versus Pitt in the Fiesta. I don't think there's a big difference to people.
Well, what's interesting is the Fiesta Bowl is actually the older of the two games, or excuse me, the Peach Bowl is the older of the two games by about 3 years. I think the Peach was in 68 and the Fiesta in 71, but you know, kind of like the Cotton Bowl, when the BCS came around, those two games were out of it, the Peach Bowl and the Cotton Bowl, but the Fiesta Bowl stayed in, it got in there. So I think that's where the recognition comes from. Either game is fine, quite honestly, if you're going to get it, because it's got that tag to it. It's a CFP New Year's Six Bowl game, which I think is important because that puts you one step outside of the national championship. And from a perception standpoint, to sell to recruits, say you come to school X and we just made a CFP bowl game, a New Year's Six bowl game, our next stop is the Final Four or whatever it will be in the future. So I think that's, you know, from a recruiting and branding standpoint, it's big to get one of those games. And it's the scenarios of the other games that I think, because you know, the three tier one bowl games are the Citrus Bowl, the Outback Bowl, and the Las Vegas Bowl, I believe. And you know how that pecking order ends up, because as I said, I think, you know, you're best off being inside that CFP rankings for Michigan State, because now you'll be assigned the bowl. But when you get to those other three games, I don't know how do you think the Big Ten would progress, Graham? I mean, because, you know, let's say chaos happens. Let's say Iowa beats Michigan. It's Iowa to the Rose Bowl. Michigan and Ohio State probably would get the Fiesta and the Peach Bowl. And then who would be the three behind that with the Citrus, Outback, and Vegas Bowl? Because
I don't think
Wisconsin and Penn State would be there. And, you know, these are now – you go from having the CFP picking to the Bowls picking.
I think Michigan State being 10-2, like Penn State 7-5, and I think the Big Ten sort of has a policy that's not written in stone, but if you're a certain amount of games ahead, I think Michigan State would go over Penn State for that reason. I think Wisconsin has also lost a fair bit of games at this point and is coming off a loss and is not really the thing that helps MSU is, one, I think people know their fans will travel and they're ready to go. Number two, they've got kind of, when they're healthy, an exciting team. They may not play a lot of defense all the time, but they play some great offense at times. And they've got players that are planning to play in games, right? So, like, you're looking at, a Heisman Trophy finalist, perhaps, and a couple receivers, one who probably will be back, and Jalen Naylor, who their best are a pretty, you know, pretty exciting group of people. So I don't see them going further down than the Citrus Bowl.
Yeah, I don't either. It would have to take, not that it would happen, but because of those big brand names with Wisconsin and Penn State. Although right now Michigan State's probably a bigger, as big of a brand name as those two. I mean, it's as remote a chance as possible that they would end up in Vegas, I would imagine. I think it's, and plus they haven't been to Florida in quite some time. I think I looked it up yesterday. All those teams, I think, are all within the window to play in either of the bowl games, be it Penn State, Michigan State, and Wisconsin. So I don't think because sometimes a team will play in a bowl game, 2 years earlier and be excluded from that pool. I think Penn State maybe in like 2011 with one of the bowl games. I think it was either the Outback or the Citrus. I can't remember. So I don't think that's a factor here, but I do think that Michigan State hasn't been to Orlando or to Florida since what, 2012? The end of the 2011 season, that year they won the Outback Bowl, which was Mark D'Antonio's first bowl win. So that's a 10-year gap between going to Florida, where they've got a huge alumni base and travel really well too. So I think those, if it's not going to be CFP, I'd put it at a 99.5% chance it'll be one of those two games as well.
I think it's interesting that there was talk that if Notre Dame, didn't fill their head coaching vacancy this week and they somehow sneak into the play, would be in position to make the playoff, that it might hurt them a little bit. Well, obviously, Michigan State doesn't have that issue with, seeing that Spartans potentially be without a coach with Mel Tucker again, of course, getting the huge contract extension, making it official at 10 p.m. On a Wednesday before Thanksgiving. Always a great time to do that. And I just think that that certainly helps. And it helps Michigan State avoid the circus that has been the past few days, with the LSU and Oklahoma, Lincoln Riley, Brian Kelly, and all that stuff. Kind of they're staying out of the hullabaloo of all that.
Yeah, and who knows, by the end of the month, Mel Tucker's deal might end up being, tempting the country.
The thing about the Tucker timing is, given what, it would have been interesting if he was not under lock and key, so to speak, when all this sort of happened and, what LSU would have been willing to do, because it looks like, despite early reports, what Brian Kelly got at LSU is the same as what Tucker got. And, which is interesting. I mean, Mel Tucker is, even though I think you're right, at a certain point, somebody described it to me as being similar to the Matthew Stafford contract. Like, it doesn't take long before it's nowhere near the highest paid deal. And at a certain point, it becomes a pretty good deal if these contracts keep going the way they are, especially a good deal because Michigan State's only paying, like 5.9 of that. Now, the length of the deal, MSU is on the hook for quite a bit, and Mel Tucker's got a pretty sweet deal going. But, the fact that donors are paying, more than a third of it, I think softens it a little bit.
I think it's interesting that the buyout was still, quote-unquote, only $2.5 million. I mean, it's good in terms of we need to avoid having schools put ridiculous buyout, offers in these contracts. But at the same time, I'm surprised how low it is.
But it's not. It's 2.5 this coming January. Then it drops to 2 million, then 1.5 million the following year. And then it'll be 1 million over the lifetime of the deal after that. So, I mean, the thought is all the money being guaranteed up front in the contract for Tucker. If you're going to want to get Mel Tucker, you're going to have to give him whatever's remaining of that $95 million. Is that a good deal for Michigan State? I don't know. I mean, if you've got donors who are willing to step up and fund things, it makes one thing. But, you don't have any return on investment. If Mel Tucker were to take an NFL job, or if he would take, let's just say he would replace Nick Saban at Alabama. Those scenarios, though, the money would still be there for them to pay the next coach, which I think is important. But they're also sending a message that, we're giving market value. So whoever they try and get whenever Mel Tucker is done at Michigan State, because it's inevitable, a coach isn't going to survive the lifetime of a program. Look at Mark D'Antonio. But whenever that happens, or whenever they have to rework the deal again, they'll have some, I think, they'll have some candidates that'll be out there and see that Michigan State is willing to pony up.
Well, before we move on to basketball, let's cover one more football topic here, and that is the Big Ten Awards, which were given out earlier this week. Mel Tucker won the Big Ten Coach of the Year. Kenneth Walker was the Big Ten Running Back of the Year. I don't think both of those were that big of surprises. Chris, your reaction to those Spartans winning those awards?
I think there was a good case for Jim Harbaugh, particularly in that last week with the win over Ohio State. But I think from the expectation and talent standpoint, plus what they did in the offseason, I think Mel Tucker was, you know, from after the Michigan game on, really pretty much coasting towards that Big Ten Coach of the Year award, because everybody had low expectations. Graham and I have talked about it, and Phil, we talked about it on the podcast. We had no expectations because we had no idea what we were going to see. And obviously it worked out into a 10-win season. And a big part of that was what he did in the portal and getting Kenneth Walker. And I think you can't say one without the other. I mean, Mel Tucker probably doesn't win the Coach of the Year without Kenneth Walker, and Kenneth Walker probably doesn't potentially get to New York as a Heisman finalist and win that Running Back of the Year award without leaving Wake Forest.
I thought the CJ Stroud over Walker deal for the, you know, player of the year or whatever in the Big Ten, offensive player of the year, was sort of a interesting and cliche pick. Like, we always pick the quarterback easily, and I'm not saying Stroud's undeserving, and he still had a big day statistically against Michigan, but the first time he faced pressure this year, his team lost, really, right? The first time people really got to him in the backfield, and he was running a really well-oiled machine with NFL wideouts, and I'm not saying he's undeserving, but Kenneth Walker elevated an entire program. And I think that, I know when those two teams were head-to-head, Walker was a little banged up. Things obviously went horribly for Michigan State. But Walker carried them to that win over Michigan. He was the difference in that game. And I just think that if you're going to look at who was truly, I mean, if you put Peyton, let me put it this way. If you put Peyton Thorne on Ohio State,
no.
How much does their season fall off? A bit? If you put, and here's a way of looking at it. I'm not making the argument for Kenneth Walker. I'm saying, but if you put Travion Henderson on Michigan State instead, where does their season go?
I mean, those are fair, you know, items, but the reality is that Ohio State had one of the top two offenses in the country.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the quarterback's always going to win that battle because he's involved in all facets of it, from throwing the ball to handing it off to running it. And making the calls, making the checks. So, you know, the running back gets the ball, see hole run. I mean, that's oversimplification of it, obviously, because of the, I mean, what Kenneth Walker has done in terms of his shiftiness, his vision, and all of that. If you would ask me, who is the better football player of those out of their performances, I would say Kenneth Walker. But when you tell me offensive player of the year, there's a lot more to it, I think, in voters' minds than just simply who put up the best numbers. I think that's part of it. I mean, you could make a good case for either one of them, and they both, you know, that's the apples to oranges comparison of putting running backs and receivers in those. Because, I mean, you can make the case here with, you know, coming into the year, I can make the case for Stroud saying coming into the year, everyone thought Garrett Wilson and Olave were the best receivers in the country. Well, look at what Smith and Jigba did with his new quarterback. So, I mean, you know, he elevated his game to the point where everyone's like, well, he's one of the best receivers in the country too. So, you know, you're kind of in a damned if you do, damned if you don't spot as a quarterback, because if you aren't doing that and using those weapons, then, you know, people are on you. But if you do, then, well, is it you? Is it the receivers? So, but I get it. I get the argument on both sides of it.
I don't have a problem with it. I just think that
there's a case to be made.
Yes, there's a case. There's a case both ways to be made. I would have made it Walker's way, but I don't think it's one of those things that's angering over. I mean, this is another guy who's going to be on the Heisman stage, probably, right? This isn't some guy who's undeserving.
Yeah. And you know what? That's kind of. you know, that the Maxwell Award that Walker is up for is exactly one of those kind of, is the best college football player. You know, it doesn't have the caveats of some of the other things. And, you know, if you put him and Stroud in that competition, I would take Kenneth Walker. I think Kenneth Walker is a better football player.
I think another point you can make in Walker's favor is that it really did take Stroud a couple of games to like really, really, really get going this season, whereas Walker was one of the best running backs in the nation from Jump Street. So, but as Graham and Chris point out, you know, that the head-to-head game really probably ultimately swung things in Stroud's favor.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's also got 2 years and 3 years in college on Stroud as well.
All right, well, let's move on to basketball, where on Wednesday night, the Spartans took on Louisville in the ACC Big Ten Challenge, and the Spartans came away with a pretty impressive victory, especially, you know, when it comes to defensively. I believe they held the Louisville's leading scorer to 0 points, and they moved up to number one in the KenPom rankings in defensive efficiency. So it seems like things are clicking offensively for the Spartans. Now, the turnovers, still a problem. 19 last night, and it feels like every time I'm looking at a Michigan State box score, they're in the high teens and 20s and whatnot. But, you know, maybe we'll come back to that later. But, again, Spartans move up, another big win, and then it really seems like they're, at least on one half of the court, kind of finding their tune, Chris.
Yeah, I think so. And it's still, I think, going to be up and down with the turnovers, partly with the adjustment to new point guards, partly with the wings just not, you know, I mean, I think there were about five really, you know, stepping on the sideline or, you know, catching the ball and walking, you know, while going to the basket, taking an extra half step. And there were a bunch of turnovers that weren't necessarily – I mean, that's the other problem. That's the other thing is those turnovers aren't, a lot of them aren't forced. They're self-created turnovers. That's a matter of focus that's going to come together at some point. But I thought there were, you know, we talked about this. There were spurts last night on Wednesday against Louisville where they turned the ball over a lot. And then there were stretches and clusters where they played some of the best basketball they played all year. They were moving the ball. They were running in transition. Hogard was getting out and finishing in traffic or getting deep into the lane and kicking it out. And Walker, I think, is really – he had finished with those 10 assists, which was a career high for him. And, Graham, you might speak to this too. I think that part of what we're seeing now is Walker understanding the guys around him and delivering the balls in better scoring positions, which can only come with that game experience.
I just think that the whole schedule they played to this point has been ideal, right? I don't remember a season where it's been more ideal in terms of not, there have been years that they've overtaxed themselves. There have been years where, but this is a year where the games have all had, I think, really good purposes and timing for what they needed to face and what they needed to see. And Louisville was an extension of that because you went through a week in the Bahamas last week where, you know, they faced sort of a crescendo of teams a little bit. You faced a very attentive Loyola team that isn't quite as long and athletic as UConn. And UConn had, you know, a great big and all that. But then Baylor was a different beast a little bit. And then so you kind of have an understanding where you are. And then you face a team that mucks it up, that defensively is very good, that has some limitations. And so you've got a chance to win a game, to feel good about yourself, to get some confidence and learn more about yourself, but also a realistic chance to win. They should beat Louisville, the Louisville team we saw last night, you know, quite often. And I think, you know, the point guard position is one of those, the more you watch, the more you see how much that's really going to, like it does many seasons, determine their year. I think Walker, to me, like, I know Hogard played well in the second half, but I think Walker is the key. I just think he is there's a separation there because he just sees the floor differently than Hogard does. And I think that, I thought last night for him, yeah, there were some, you know, you asked him about the steals and everything last night when we were at the press conference afterwards. And, you know, he's got a real knack for some certain things, for playmaking in certain settings. Yeah. He's got a knack when things break down, like, Hogard, obviously, the two faults of Hogard is, one, he drives the ball in too far sometimes and plows into people and doesn't see what's happening around him. And the other thing is, if what's scripted doesn't happen, he's not as good as Walker is. Walker just feels it. And I think we started to see that last night.
I think that, you know, some of that, you know, is going to eventually, the particularly Hogard going kind of bull in a china shop into the post when he's driving like that, that'll end up on scouting reports and you'll start to see more charges. So he's going to have to show a little bit in the pull up game and kind of, I did like what he did in terms of getting into the deep into the post and kicking the ball out. And I think that was a critical reason that they had, I think, 10 3-pointers. They shot the ball lights out all night from the three, which was big. You know, I think the other part of this is that we kind of got to touch on what's going on with Joey Hauser, because, you know, that's a critical component right now. As much as the turnovers have been an issue, you know, across the board, you know, not getting the production from Joey Hauser on the scoring side and on the defensive side is painful to watch, because, you know, we saw what this kid was a year ago in those first six non-conference games and lived up to the billing. And then after Christmas, it was just a drop off. And Tom Izzo was pretty frank about the heat that Hauser took from people and has been taking from people and as being part of it. But he also said that they need more from
him. He took some heat from Izzo yesterday. And during the game and, you know, he's not playing well. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, if you look at
did you see the whole sequence with that? He came out. Izzo pulled him after. Yeah. I think it was after a turnover. And Izzo tried to talk to him, and Hauser blew right by him.
Yeah,
and wasn't listening. And Izzo grabbed him, followed him down the bench, and, you know, sat there, gave him a speech, walked away, came back, sat next to him, and then. You know, so, and I think it's important to mention that Izzo said that he really cares about Joey Hauser. And, you know, I think that's painfully abundant. I mean, he's given him significant minutes and put him back in the starting rotation again after sitting the three games in the Bahamas. So he has high expectations for the kid. You know, and that's, you know, but if you're I think he was a -9 on the defensive side and continues to get blown by on that side, which we saw last year. He struggled defensively mightily. That's not his strength. Shooting is his strength, and that's not a strength at all either right now. I mean, he came back into the game after that little tete-a-tete with Izzo and just started chucking from, you know, he'd catch the ball and he was – you know, 35, 40 feet away and just throwing it up. And that's, you know, I don't know if that's the right idea either, but, you know, there's got to be some, I don't know. He's got to find some stability there. Otherwise, you know, Malik Hall will get his minutes and Pierre Brooks might get his minutes. And, you know, maybe you see more of the two guard lineup with Walker and Hogard and you push Christie to the three and Brown to the four. I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, but, you know, they need Joey Hauser to be a productive player. It doesn't mean he has to be averaging a double-double. It's just, he has to be able to produce.
He's got to hit open shots.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing is, because otherwise, I mean, that's his skill that makes him – I mean, he's never been a great defensive player. He wasn't at Marquette. He was, you know, that's not going to be his thing. And the thing is, if you look at, you know, he's -9 last night in a game that they win by 9. And Malik Hall is +18, and that's your counterpart. And clearly finding a rhythm as a consistent guy. I mean, Hall is the answer is well, you play Hall 30 minutes and just use Hauser less in those, you know, roles where he's also playing a little center or moving Hall to the three. And you know, here's the tough news for Joey Hauser. And I get that there if you go on Twitter, and I hope he doesn't. There are people that are absolutely cruel. This is a college kid who's absolutely trying his best, and he's in a bad way right now. But here's kind of the bad news from him from a playing perspective. One, the guy who was your original platoon mate and no longer is having a breakout stretch here, and Malik Hall. The other thing that's happening is Tom Izzo is on record saying that Malik Hall is better at the four. Right. The other, so the idea of playing them at the 3-4 together is a little less enticing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, last night Izzo talked about Max Christie and Joey Hauser together being sort of his best shooters in practice, and yet Max Christie is not letting what happens on the offensive end mess with his defense. He was great defensively, held Noah Locke to 0 points last night for Louisville, and is playing it just within himself, and is not and Hauser is getting better looks and not hitting him, and doesn't give you the things that Christie does. And then you get the addition of, you bring up a guy like Pierre Brooks, who comes in, and those were real rotation minutes last night. Like those were, because he played twice in the first half. And then you know you're in the rotation, because Izzo has constantly done this with young guys over the years. A guy gets two times in the first half and then doesn't play in the second. You're not really in the rotation until you play in the second in a competitive game. Well, he did. He got the, and he's had a guy like this before that gets the two times in the first half and the one in the second. And that's the spot that Pierre Brooks has moved into. And when you start to look at those minutes, some of them I think were Mati Sissoko's spot minutes last night. But when you start to look at those minutes, they're going to be Joey Hauser's minutes. Eventually, you have to produce, and it's a brutal spot to be in, because he's not getting support from the crowd. There was actually boos last night when he turned the ball over at one point. He's not getting, and he feels it. He knows it. But ultimately, this is Big Ten college basketball, and you have to play at a certain level. It goes. I remember asking Tom Izzo about Keon Coleman and Malik Carr at the media day. And Izzo didn't blow off the idea of them joining the team, but he said, we'll see. And then he said about them ever having a role, you know, it's competitive. It's competitive at this level. The idea that they could walk in and get, for Joey Hauser, it's competitive. And eventually, no matter how much Izzo likes you, and no matter how much people feel bad, or in some cases people don't feel bad, you have to produce at a level that earns the playing time. And right now, I don't think he is, frankly.
Yeah. With Coleman and Carr, I mean, there's a reason that there aren't many Charlie Wards out there, right? I mean, you need to be a supreme high level elite athlete. I mean, it's, you know, even the occasional Matt Trannon, or, you know, even Andre Rison when he played. I mean, those guys were freak athletes, but they also weren't starters. They were role players in their secondary sport. You know, when they did play, but you're right. I do think, I mean, cause if Brooks starts getting more minutes, then that means that those minutes are going to be basically Malik Hall's at the three, and Hall's minutes in the three will go to the four and take over more of Hauser. And Hauser's a shooter. So how do you as a shooter adjust your mindset to being, instead of finding a rhythm, being a plug and play guy off the bench? I mean, it's hard for a kid that has been, you know, been able to for the entirety of his life, find a rhythm with his shot, you know, shooting 20, 15, 18, you know, 10, 15, 20 shots a game. I mean, that's not the role that he's going to be in right now. So how do you adjust to that? And I think that's compounding with the pressure of the external side, with the fans and with everybody else.
It's the worst thing, you know. Chris Hill,
yeah,
you know, late in his career struggled and lost some confidence. It's one of the perils of being, of having your sort of Division I worth being as a shooter, is that if you lose confidence, what you do that got you to that level, especially well, it gets taken away. Like if your strength is defense, you know, you can just lock in and do your thing. One of the things everybody, you know, Jaden Akins right now has become a fan favorite, right? And there are a lot of reasons for that. When he's in the air, he is gliding. It is a beautiful thing. It is like the antithesis of you and me jumping, Chris or Phil. What's that?
What's jumping? I haven't done that in a while.
It's when you put a single sheet of paper and you get over it on the ground. But anyway, so he's a beautiful player to watch, and he's a defender, he's a rebounder, and he plays all the roles that you like. The other thing that helps him be beloved, right, is he's not playing point guard, which people thought he would come into play. So he's not part of their turnover problem. if he was a true freshman playing 20 minutes a game at point guard and turning the ball over three times a game, and that was still this major issue, people would like him, but it wouldn't be this sort of, you know, I think there's a kind of a love affair with him a little bit, and understandably so. And so I think sometimes it's what your role is. You know, when Kenny Goins was in that role, people liked him when he was the rebound hustle guy off the bench, and then he became the guy at center people scored over and people hated him. Joey Hauser is in a position now where what he does and his value is plain to see, because largely it's he's getting a lot of open looks and he's missing
it. It's the Rocket Watts freshman year versus Rocket Watts sophomore year argument.
Yeah.
You'll be beloved if you're playing on the wing and you've got a point guard who's holding down the fort, and you know all you got to do is hit a few shots here or there and play some defense. But when more responsibility falls on you to score, to attack, to create for others, and you aren't doing it, then there's a turn. And I think that's something that Hauser, it didn't help him that his coach put those expectations on him when he transferred by saying that he's the piece to a national title.
Yeah, no, Izzo hurt him with the hyperbole going in.
But I think people misinterpreted that as him being a superstar who can lead you a national title, versus being a piece within the construct of the guys that they had with Tillman and Winston and you know the other players that year that he very well may have been a piece to that a potential national championship that year with the guys that were around him, but he wouldn't have had the expectations of being a 20 point a game guy, or a 10 point a game guy. Which is what now you are, when you're that far on and you don't have a go-to guy, which Izzo has talked about quite a bit. That you were expected to maybe grow into that role, and it's not there now. So you got to readjust your role and expectations, but those expectations are from Izzo 2 years ago linger over him, even though it had nothing to do. Is he any different of a player in those 2 years? No, but it was the pieces that were around him at that point.
Right. But I think if we went back and looked at the audio or the quotes from Izzo and that like opening media day or whenever it was about, there was a year about Hauser that it was, because I understand that point, that I do think if he came in the year that he was, if he had been eligible to play, and he doesn't think about it because he never thought he was going to be eligible, but he'd been eligible to play with Cassius Winston feeding him the ball and Xavier Tillman protecting him defensively, that he would have had a really good year. I totally agree with that. And he might have been a piece to a national championship caliber team that would have been taken away by the pandemic.
And he could have averaged, 6 to 8 points a game, which may have been his ceiling anyways. And he would have been a different 6 to 8 points a game when you have Winston and Tillman than it is when you've got the current construct with no star.
He might have done better than that. I think if you look back at those quotes from Izzo, it was more than that. It was very much,
I believe this guy
passes like magic, so to speak. I mean? It was a lot of stuff.
That part was a little bit of hyperbole.
That was
very Sparky Anderson. Barbaro Garbe is the next Roberto Clemente kind of talk.
Yeah.
Very timely reference there, Chris. I love it. I will say that Hauser scored the first basket of the game, I believe, last night. And I thought, well, maybe this is the game he kind of turns things around. And that obviously that did not happen. But maybe another day for him.
You know how he did it? He went to the basket. And scored. And that's and I think it's got to be the same thing that they've been trying with Max Christie. And the problem though is Max Christie has better athleticism. Get to the rim, get fouled, get to the free throw line, build your rhythm that way. I don't know if Hauser's going to be able to do that, because he may be able to do that in a game like Toledo on Saturday. But once you start getting into Big Ten play and the guys that are checking you are a little quicker than you and you're not able to turn the corner and draw contact, that's going to be difficult. But if he's able to do that, I think that's big. I mean, there were times when he was posting up hard in front of us trying to get the ball. So, again, it's not like the kid's in loaf mode. I think that he's more in lost mode, that when things aren't going right, he doesn't know exactly what to do because he's never experienced this sort of adversity as a player in his life.
He needs to see the ball go in. Like, you know, there's some times where you go, well, it's just Toledo and matchups matter. And there's no question. Like there are guys who can star against Toledo and that doesn't mean squat in the Big Ten. But Toledo's a good program, but you know what I mean? The relative to athlete length and all that. But Hauser's getting good looks, and he's getting good looks because of the way the offense works, because of the way he plays off of Tyson Walker. Like, those looks are going to always be there for him. And also, at this point, I don't care if he's up against the three of us with two ghosties as the fourth and fifth defender. He needs to see the ball go in the rim, and he needs to see it happen in front of people. And if it happens at Breslin, where people can see him hit shots, and he starts – because to me, at this point, it's mostly about him feeling okay about himself as a shot, and then from there you work about the levels of competition. But at this point, that's the thing that's got to happen.
You bring up the crowd factor, and I think that's important because I do think it is important for him to hear that, because remember he hasn't heard that. What's interesting is I was talking to Marcus Bingham last night and asked him about that alley-oop that he had in transition from Walker, where it just kind of seemed like he hung in the air forever and Breslin just went nuts when he threw it down. He said that's the first time in his career that he felt that energy and that loudness for something that he did. He's like, usually I've been on the bench for that, because that's what that last year has done. You know, Bingham played a lot of minutes last year. He played a lot of important roles last year. But he didn't do it in front of fans, so that there is a confidence, and you could see it in the joy in his face of talking about it and recounting it and hearing that. You're right. I think Hauser needs to hear that too. I mean, because ultimately, that's, you know, there's the boos aren't what you want to hear as a player, particularly your home crowd. You want to hear that cheer and that roar because that's what restores confidence.
Well, if you think it doesn't, so I just got a tweet from a reader who said, he was at the game last night and doesn't believe he's ever heard as many groans and negative comments from Spartan fans about one of their own players. And this is where it matters, because Hauser will begin to anticipate it. He'll begin to hear this. I did a column several years ago about this was the end of the late in the Travis Trice era. This was, I think, the 14-15 team that made the Final Four but was a bubble team for part of that year. And their home road free throw percentage of certain players was astounding.
Yes.
I think Travis Trice was like 86% on the road and 60% at home from the free throw line, which all had everything to do with, because they had started missing, it became an issue. You could hear the air sucked out of the room when the ball was about to go up and the groans when they missed, and it became a thing in their heads.
The free throws in that season, in the 2014-15 season, were the turnovers this season. Yeah. It was a perpetual and constant story that you couldn't shake until postseason.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I think fans need to be wary of that. Now, look, fans pay their tickets. They have the right to go and – but I would say if you care about the results of the team and you care about the kids on the team, the just don't say anything if you can't say something nice rule would be the best way to tackle the Joey Hauser situation and give the kid time to figure it out. And remember, he's a human. Remember, he has a mother. I mean, that's, you know, one of the things that, you know, I try to, with everything I always write, I try to remind myself, this person has a mom. You know what I mean? Like, that is, you got to humanize them. Like, how, you know, and they got a
family.
Fans
don't care. Fans nowadays don't care.
Some do. Fans get caught up in things. I think they do care ultimately.
I think there's an age gap in that. I think, yeah. I really do. I think younger fans and maybe, you know, in hindsight, in my fandom over the years when I was a kid, there's probably some of that as well. Is like you appreciate and understand that a little bit when you get older and maybe, you know, either have kids or your friends have kids and you see them going through it versus when you're of that age or not too far removed from that age and, you know, your be all and end all is following these people and their athletic exploits.
You talked about, you know, saying something nice, and I'll say something nice here about Malik Hall. 15 points, 5 rebounds, 2 assists, 6 of 8 shooting, 3 of 3 3-pointers in 24 minutes. Pretty, pretty, pretty good for him last night.
Doesn't help Hauser.
No, it doesn't.
No. No, but he, you know, it's real important for Michigan State because he needs to, and you know, he had the sprained ankle against Baylor early in that game, and the but he didn't do a lot against UConn either, and you know, he needs to, and he talked about just something he struggles with, figuring out the consistency and how to get his within the offense with it, because he's not a one-on-one type player guy, you know, and but he is a guy that when this team is looking for consistent scoring and guys who can do things in spurts that change games. Like last night, his quick 8 points in 90 seconds changed that game. It went from being a competitive game to a Michigan State comfortably in control for most of the second half from there on. And they need him to be that sort of guy and to do it against good athletes and have faith in himself to do it. And he's a third-year guy who's shown an array of skills. And it's time. It's time for him to be that guy.
I don't disagree at all. And it's, I mean, when you talk about those minutes at the four, he's the better defender as well. I mean, Izzo's talked about his ability to guard multiple positions over the course of his time, and you know that ultimately is there. You know, that's, you know, there's no question who the better option defensively is between him and Hauser. So that's, you know. I just wonder, at some point, does Gabe Brown have to slide to the four for some of those minutes? If you do end up replacing him, but Hall is such an integral part of this team right now. I'm curious to see how the starting position moves forward, because you know Hauser ended up playing, you know, 15, 16 minutes. Hall played 24 plus. Does that number, is there a slide rule on that? Does Hall's minutes go up and Hauser's go down? I don't know.
What's interesting about this team is they're pretty good. They're winning a lot of games. They have, you can see all this potential for them being a very good team and maybe being in the thick of everything. Maybe not against Purdue. Purdue looks like they might be at another level in the Big Ten. And yet there's so much we're learning about them game by game, and so much that still has to be developed. I mean, if this team's going to – I mean, and that's one of the reasons they have a high ceiling, though, is guys like Malik Hall are finding themselves still. Guys like Max Christie are finding themselves still. At the point guard position, they're finding themselves still. So, I mean, they're doing this, and part of it is their defense has gotten pretty good, and they've got a pretty good defensive identity if you look at the numbers there, and that's that can carry you a ways.
You want to know one of the quietest developments of that game against Louisville – was how poorly Marcus Bingham started that game, but how strong he finished. Because, you know, if we want to run the parallel with Hauser, you know, Bingham in the past could have very easily, after, you know, turning the ball over, taking ill-advised shots, getting lost. I mean, there were a number of things that he did maybe in the first 3 minutes that he played where he thought this is going to be one of those nights where Izzo's going to have a quick hook on him and sit him down. But he came back. He went strong to the basket. He finished at the rim. He attacked the boards. He responded to it. And he talked about hearing the coaching and hearing that hard language sometimes that Izzo has. And you've got to understand what he's doing and trying to drive you to be better. You know, and I think that's, you know, that was a sign to me of a maturing Marcus Bingham. Which, you know, all the other things that you saw in that Louisville game, that one was one that was a little hidden there. He finished what 9 points and 12 boards, but he attacked the basket and he got to the free throw line four times. So those are the things that they want from him.
And congrats to the Big Ten for winning the ACC Big Ten Challenge 8-6. I'm ready to get hurt again in March when I pick a number of Big Ten teams to make deep tournament runs, only to see them lose in the first and second round.
Oh boy, that's been there's a crazy challenge. You know, Michigan got thumped by North Carolina, and was it Syracuse, Indiana going to double overtime, and Nebraska, and who the heck Nebraska? That one was another one of those doozy overtime games that went crazy. So I mean, buckle up, because you know, Big Ten, what, about a week and a half from now, Big Ten season starts, 2 weeks.
Yep, exactly. All right, the Spartans will play Saturday against Toledo, so we'll see what's next in the forward battle, and we'll see who plays, who gets the minutes and whatnot. But before we sign off this week, I want to get your guys' predictions for what the Final Four will be in the college football playoff. Graham?
Well, it's a great question because it's hard to know what Alabama Georgia will look like, and if Alabama loses, are they out, and how far do they, like, if Alabama loses, Alabama field goal, are they done? You know, I think Cincinnati's got a tough game, but I'll say Cincinnati's going to win and be in. I think the that'll help the fact that the Notre Dame coaching situation is being resolved, and it looks like Luke Fickell will be there. You know, I think Michigan will win. I think it's a bad matchup for Iowa. I think Georgia is an absolute beast. And so I think that next team is probably Oklahoma State if they beat Baylor. And so that would be my guess right now over Alabama, depending on – I think Georgia is going to put one up. This is like a – this is a real demon for Georgia, yeah. Alabama has been. I think they're going to really try to put one on Alabama. And I think Alabama, unfortunately for Alabama, is not what they've been. Give me Oklahoma State as that 14.
Graham, I am 100% with you on the Georgia-Alabama thing. I think Georgia puts it to them pretty handily, and that will knock Alabama out of the playoff. And I have the exact same four teams. I think everybody holds serve, and I think it'll be Georgia, Michigan, Cincinnati, Oklahoma State as your four, which I'm excited about because you kind of get some new blood in there if that's how it plays out instead of, you know, the same old, same old.
So that clearly means that Graham foresees another Michigan State Alabama game in the Fiesta Bowl.
I think
wouldn't it be Notre Dame?
It'd probably would be Notre Dame. I
think Gamma will wind up in the Sugar. I could be wrong on that. I was trying to read the SEC rules on that, and what.
Yeah.
I think Bama's more likely to go to the Sugar, but I could be. This wouldn't be a horrible year to face Bama though, even though Michigan State's not a juggernaut either. I mean, you're not going to likely to get run off the field. In other words,
I'm going to go the other direction with this. I think that it's going to be Georgia. I think it's going to be Michigan. I think they're going to win that game against Iowa. I think it's going to be a slugfest and a slog fest.
Ooh, I don't. I think the Wolverines rout Iowa.
I think it's going to be akin to the 2015. That's just the style that Iowa wants to play. Sure. I mean, they want to. Both of these teams want to run the ball and grind it. It's going to be an old school Big Ten game where I wouldn't put the over much more than 40, 45 in it. I think Cincinnati's in there at the three spot, and I think Notre Dame.
Wow.
I think
Notre Dame jumps Oklahoma State.
I think Notre Dame makes the jump because of the one loss being against Cincinnati. And yeah. I think that ultimately ends up helping them, that they get a little boost on that. So
it'll be very.
And the Big 12 is in such disarray that, you know, I'm not sure that Oklahoma State will even win.
Yeah,
no, that's a good point. That's honest. A really good point. That's a good point. You know, and that's Notre Dame's path, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think Oklahoma State would get over Notre Dame if Oklahoma State wins, just because Oklahoma State's got a couple like top 15 wins. I don't think Notre Dame has any, if I recall, any, maybe one or zero top 25 wins. So
got to beat Baylor first.
I'm saying if in that scenario, if they beat Baylor, right? But they've already beaten Oklahoma. They've already beaten.
It's a fun Texas final A&M, weekend though, because right? There's a lot at stake. And just imagine if there's a 12 team playoff, how cool this would be this weekend. But yeah, there's a lot. I'm excited to see it. And I like that. Like Oklahoma State making the playoff after Oklahoma says, "Nah, we're going to the Big 12," and then their coach says, "Screw it, I'm going to an easier league to dominate with USC." Like this might be the ultimate kiss off. Like, go ahead, you're going to be fighting for relevancy in the SEC. We'll stay here in the Big 12 and make the playoff. I would. Part of me would enjoy that.
I mean, that's also probably partially why Lincoln Riley said peace out and I'm going to USC where I can in a couple years, if not year one, just win the Pac-12 every single year and be in the playoff.
Of course, the little secret there is that the wins and games against the name programs like Oklahoma and Texas with those committees still carry more weight than probably actually deserve.
It's true.
And if you don't have those marquee wins, you run yourself the Cincinnati situation. I mean, if Cincinnati doesn't have that Notre Dame win, where are they at?
Yeah.
Even undefeated.
And Gary Bart is not the first logic challenged person to run this committee. So it'll be interesting to see what transpires.
Yeah.
This
what also hurt Cincinnati, it turned out Indiana was just a complete turned into a complete dumpster fire.
No, but I'm all about intent and scheduling.
Yeah.
And like to me, and that's one of the reasons you got to get the 12 too, because like to me, these games get scheduled a bit out in advance. And if you're trying to play high majors on the road and they wind up having a horrible year, like I would love scheduling conversations to be public. I would love to know if Cincinnati called Alabama to say, hey, would you be up for playing us? And if Alabama said no, I'd like that to be a factor. I think intent and scheduling absolutely should matter.
I'm with you, Graham. All right. Any final thoughts before we sign off for this week?
No prediction, I guess. Huh? No game.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, football game for do you want to predict we predicted the playoff. Do you want to predict a Toledo game?
I'm never a fan of basketball predictions, even though I have basketball games. You know,
it's hard to do. Plus, I don't know. I mean, I know a little bit about Toledo's program because you know I'm that guy. But
you are.
But and
did
I know
you covered Western Michigan before. Is that correct?
And I know Justin Ingram from Lansing is on that Toledo staff.
That is true.
But I do not have a lot of intel, so it would be me just blindly throwing out a number.
Yeah, you know, as we were doing this, the Walter Camp Football Foundation Player of the Year honors came out, and you know the finalists are Jordan Davis of Georgia, Kenny Pickett of Pitt, Bryce Young of Alabama, no C.J. Stroud, Michigan's Aiden Hutchinson, and Michigan State's Kenneth Walker.
Mm. Wow,
interesting.
So, again. The irony, of course, being that Kenneth Walker ran for 260-some yards at Northwestern and 4 touchdowns, and Walter Camp Foundation snubbed him in that. So take that for what it's worth.
Are we still mad about that? That feels like 5 lifetimes ago. All right. Well, thank you for joining us for this edition of Spartan Speak, a production of the Lansing State Journal, Detroit Free Press, and the USA Today Network. If you enjoy this podcast and the work surrounding it, please consider subscribing. You can follow our coverage at lsj.com, freep.com, and on Twitter at Graham_Couch, at Chris Solari, at Phil_Friend, and at LSJ Green White. Thanks for listening.